essentially from Marx and Marxism and liquidates the revolution of capital. Badiou conceives of the relation between freedom and equality as an ontological one in the mathematical terms of set theory, transhistoricizing it. Badiou's background is in Lacanian and Althusserian post-structuralist French thought, in common with other prominent New Left-era thinkers and former students of Althusser, such as Étienne Balibar and Jacques Rancière. Althusser found in the Russian and Chinese revolutions a salutary challenge to the notion of the Hegelian logic of history, that revolutionary change could and indeed did happen as a matter of contingency. Althusser took great inspiration from Mao in China and Lenin in Russia for advancing the possibility of emancipation against a passive expectancy of automatic evolution in the historical process of capital. For Badiou, this means that emancipation must be conceived of as an event, which involves a fundamental reconsideration of ontology. Badiou does not conceive of the transformation of the capitalist mode of production that would allow for overcoming the socially pernicious aspects of specifically capitalist forms of inequality. By contrast, Marx looked forward to the potential for overcoming the conditions of possibility for the reproduction of capitalist class dynamics in the mode of production itself, capital's overcoming of the need to accumulate the value of surplus labor time. Marx saw the historical potential to overcome the socially mediating aspect of labor, expressed, for instance, in automated machine production. However, Marx also foresaw that, short of socialism, the drive to accumulate surplus value results in producing a surplus population, an industrial reserve army of potential workers who thus remain vulnerable to exploitation. A politics based only in their democratic discontents can result not in the overcoming of the social need for labor, but rather in the capitalist demand for more labor, the demand to be put to work. Or, as Max Horkheimer, the director of the Marxist Frankfurt Institute for Social Research, put it, machines have, quote, not made work, but rather the workers, superfluous. Marx anticipated this when he warned that realization of the socialist demand to abolish private property would merely make society as a whole into one giant capitalist dominating its members. Marx even went so far as to analogize this with socialist calls to abolish marriage as a bourgeois institution, which he said would only result in universal prostitution. Indeed, capitalism was already bringing this about. For Marx, elimination of a separate capitalist class would not in itself be emancipatory, unless a transformation in the mode of production and its social relations came about. Marx did not think that the capitalists were the cause, but rather the effect of capital, calling them its character masks. Nonetheless, Marx endorsed, however critically, the traditional socialist demand to abolish private property and expropriate the expropriators, regarding this as a necessary first step, necessary but not sufficient to realize a society beyond the mode of production and social relations of capital. As Lenin underscored this in the State and Revolution, on the eve of the October 1917 revolution in Russia, such social relations of bourgeois society, namely the mutual exchange of labor as the form of social solidarity in capital, could only be transformed gradually and thus wither away and not be abolished and replaced at one stroke. The proletarian socialist revolution was supposed to open the door to this transformation and not in and of itself be this transformation. But since then, the history of the Russian and Chinese revolutions showed another potential, that is, the reconstitution of capital under the guise of socialism. Marx had already foreseen such a possibility in the limited consciousness of his socialist and communist contemporaries of the 19th century, and he criticized them ruthlessly for this. Marx and Lenin recognized a problem in socialism itself that their supposed followers have neglected or avoided. All of this remains hidden to Badiou. But it was precisely this Marxist approach to capital as a mode of production or form of society that distinguishes Marx from other socialists or communists and motivated revolutionaries who followed Marx, such as Lenin, who maintained that Marxism pursued the possibility of overcoming capital, quote, on the basis of capitalism itself. Badiou situates emancipatory possibilities rather atavistically in a prehistorical ontology to which the philosophy of mathematics, for instance, the question of number and numbers, the title of one of his books, can be an adequate guide. For Badiou, in a procedure that recalls a self-criticism session or an assembly at a re-education camp, matter itself, in its open-ended recombinations, poses the solution to what Marx called communism, the riddle of history. Each element must be broken down to its radical potentiality for permutation, for instance, in the Maoist revolutionary people, for emancipatory change to take place. It is not for nothing that Badiou conceives of revolution not as a process but an event, or that his conception of process is founded on a conception of the event. On the other hand, Badiou finds Marxists, such as Lenin and Marx himself, as conceding too much to the existing social hierarchies and thus betraying the idea of communism. For instance, in the party state, which Badiou regards in retrospect as a failed experiment. Thus, Badiou. But what of Marx and Marxism? Marx distinguished capitalist inequality from that of the traditional caste system that had characterized civilization for millennia before the emergence of bourgeois society in the post-Renaissance world. As Adorno, for one, pointed out, to call all of history the history of class struggles was to indict all of recorded history, and to thus consign it to the mere prehistory of authentic humanity. But this humanity was itself historically specific and emergent, a product of capital. Just as traditional inequality was not the cause of the form of community that the ancients regarded as divine in origin, capitalist inequality was not the cause but the effect, the product of the cosmos of capital. Marx's magnum opus, Kapital, explored how the post-industrial revolution society of capital produced a new form of inequality between capitalist and worker, but one liable to be cast and responded to in the form of the original revolt of the Third Estate that had ushered in modern bourgeois society in the 17th and 18th centuries. Marx thus found an important disparity, a self-contradiction, to have developed between the political aspirations of the subjects of capital for social democracy and the potential of capital to go beyond bourgeois society and its forms of politics, namely liberalism and democracy. This did not make Marx and those who followed him illiberal or anti-democratic, but they did regard liberalism and democracy, the combined libertarian and social egalitarian impulses in modern politics, as means and not ends in and of themselves. This is because they regarded capitalism itself as a process and not merely as a state of being. Marx and his best followers, such as Lenin, looked forward not merely to more liberalism and more democracy, but to the potential transcendence of the need for both liberalism and democracy, an end to politics as presently practiced, but not all at once and not by denying them in the present. Capital is not an eternal event of inequality that needs to be met with the event of revolution. Badiou does not deny liberalism or democracy, but rather unconsciously reaffirms their present bourgeois forms at a deeper and more obscure level. Badiou's ontology of radical egalitarian democracy provides not a critical recognition, but a philosophical affirmation of the way bourgeois society already proceeds, however contradictorily. Badiou thus mystifies. The challenge is to recognize the symptomatic character of liberalism and democracy in the crisis of capital, as it had developed in the 19th century, setting the stage for the history that came later. But such symptomology was not to be cured in the sense of elimination, but rather undergone and worked through. As Nietzsche put it, modernity is an illness, but the way pregnancy is an illness, bringing forth new life. The problem, as Marx recognized it, was that by the mid-19th century, when bourgeois society entered into crisis after the Industrial Revolution and became proletarianized, humanity faced a situation in which, as Engels later described it, the capitalists were no longer, and the workers not yet able, to master the society of capital. Marx regarded this as the source of the authoritarianism of the modern capitalist nation-state, despite the promises of classical bourgeois liberalism for a minimal state and a free cosmopolitan civil society that would, for instance, reduce legislatures to, at most, sites of public debate and political recognition of social facts already accomplished on the ground, what Kant, for one, expected. But the bourgeoisie could no longer, and the proletariat not yet, rule modern society. The genie of capital had been let loose. The historical task of emancipating humanity had thus fallen from the bourgeois to the proletarian members of society. Marxists have recognized that this is the situation in which the world has remained stuck ever since then, ever since the failed social democratic revolutions of 1848, on the eve of which Marx and Engels had published their inaugural manifesto. For Marx, the demand for social democracy was part of the history of capital, to be worked through imminently and transcended on its own basis. But none of this registers for Badiou. Marx marked a potential turning point for humanity. He was not merely one in a chain of prophets reaching back for thousands of years. He was a thinker and a political actor for our modern time. The cost of liquidating the specific history of capital, its peculiar constraint on society, and its potential beyond itself, is Badiou's reduction of communism to the perennial complaint of the subaltern, the millennial dream of social equality, as a specter haunting the world that has more in common with eschatological justice posed by religion at the end of time than with the specific pathology of the modern bourgeois world of capital in which humanity actually suffers today. We must awaken from this nightmare, the vain wish that things be otherwise, of the oppressed. For we are not only oppressed, but also tasked by capital. Nevertheless, the failure of historical Marxism has made Badiou an evidently adequate symptomatic expression of our time, its confusion and diminished expectations, well shy of the epochal transformation that had motivated Marx and the best Marxists historically. We must remember Marxism so we can forget Badiou, forget the time that made such ideology, such naturalization, indeed ontologization of defeat, so appealing, and finally consign it where it belongs to prehistory.
John and Joe are going to speak to some of the particulars of Badiou's contribution. What I had carved out for myself is just to talk for a moment about the situation of communism at this moment in history. And Chris's presentation there kind of leads into mine, because I do want to talk about the cry of the subaltern and the need to abolish oppression in particular. And I think when we look at that, we can start anywhere. This morning when I was thinking about this and coming here, I saw an article that the number of black men in prison is roughly equal to, by one calculation, the number of black men who were enslaved in 1850. So there's your bourgeois emancipatory process. Or I was thinking about, you know, just trying to grasp and understand the effect on our world of this incredible movement of hundreds of millions of people driven out of semi-feudal villages into shanty towns. And you have the freedom of bourgeoisie, the freedom of movement, which was denied for centuries, and suddenly capitalism uses it as a way of creating new horrors. Or the sale of 1 million girls a year, mainly in Asia, from these same villages as feudalism collapses. And there you have, once again, capitalism revolutionizing the world in unprecedented ways and then using it in new ways, new horrors, new exploitation. And that's sort of what floods into our minds in the morning when we wake up. That's what makes us communists. And the part that makes it particularly intolerable is that for the first time in history, we can do something else. Human knowledge, human productive capacity. Humans have always suffered. Humans have always slaughtered each other and lived in desperation and poverty and starvation and famine and then in the midst of that created beautiful things. It's not an existence of horror. But it's no longer necessary. And so the contradiction poses itself, how do we get out of here? And it's particularly acute just because of the dynamism of the modern society and the weakness of communism, which I would like to talk about a little bit. And Mao said that Marxism consists of 1,000 truths, and they boil down to one. You know, that doesn't mean the other truths don't exist, but that they can boil down to one, and that is that it is right to rebel against reactionaries. And if you think of that philosophically, it embodies a particular view of truths, which is part of the issue with Badiou, and a particular view of Marxism, and also a particular view of our communist project. And it starts, interestingly enough, with a moral statement of what is right. It's not an analysis. It's a stand. And that's what it describes to Marxism. It's a moral judgment that it's right to make revolution. And it's right for people to find the courage, which is very difficult, and the hope to rise up against these things. And so, you know, again, I think that's the background for which the communist project emerges. And I was thinking today of Martin Luther. When Martin Luther took his stand, he said in German, "Hier stehe ich, ich kann nicht anders." Here I stand, I can do nothing else. And often for us, it seems like we can do nothing else. But in reality, the road of revolution is a choice. It's a choice for those who make it the focus of our lives, and it's also the choice for the people who rise up. It's a decision. And there's a very sharp struggle that goes on in our hearts and in our ranks over whether one can serve the people and whether, you know, where we're going with that. And one of the things I just wanted to affirm is that, you know, for a lot of the history of the Communist Project, where the question of periodization comes in, the attraction, a lot of the 20th century, has been communism's association with political liberty and with the project of economic modernization. It's true in Russia, it was true in China in many ways. And I think that has always been part of the picture, and that it is less the picture now in extremely important ways because of the development of capitalism. And that I think it's especially important to assert that capitalist modernity, as you were saying in your panel, is this huge historic break with the feudalism it emerged out of. Just like, frankly, slavery was a huge break from, I mean, Roman slavery was a huge, mind-boggling break from the tribalism that it emerged out of. I mean, these are huge changes. But I do think we have to affirm that what we want to do is a negation of capitalist modernization. We are its grave diggers. Capitalism raises the question of popular sovereignty in an important, at least European capitalism does, in an important historical way. But we are nonetheless negating their forms of popular sovereignty, their ideas of electoral democracy, their concept of freedom, and I mean negation in the Maoist sense that also involves an interpenetration of opposites, which I'm not going to go in any further. But I do think the idea of a new and even more radical break than the French Revolution could have imagined. And so the other side of this, you know, and something that's very present when people start looking around thinking of radical change is just, you know, the other side of this, that achieving that kind of a break, there they stand, the Marines, the CIA, the killer police, the authorities in schools, patriarchs with their bald fists in every family, you know, pimps, human traffickers, border police, hangmen in every country. So the wealth of capitalism has accreted this apparatus of repression and murder that, you know, so you say, I want a radical world. Well, it's hard to imagine one. You say you want to build a radical world. Really? Well, it's hard to build one. You say you're going to defeat them. Well, that's like a, you know, you really have to get real then. You have to think that one through. And I think that's part of what, you know, we actually need to talk about is thinking those things through. You know, and Maoism starts, you know, there's a thing in Maoism called the mass line, which centers on the appreciation that this takes conscious people in their millions. And if you want to tear up the roots of that apparatus that holds us under these conditions, you actually have to find the ways to connect with millions of people and transform consciousness, not like pour my consciousness into their heads, but actually transform consciousness through a living process. And if we don't go, you know, if we don't involve our process in our stuff, it's not a matter of utopian hopes, but it is real, and it has to have a whiff of gunpowder and violence. I mean, if you don't approach the world with that understanding, you know, then what world are we living in? You know, it's going to take millions of people and bitter sacrifice. And so with that, I'd just like to start talking about where our communist project is at, because in many ways it's invisible. And it's invisible because of the that's where the periodization comes in, because an arc has happened, and there's a huge debate in society. And actually, there's, you know, we dominated, we contended on a world scale for a century. You know, I think if you take, you know, from the rise of German social democracy in the late 1800s to the restoration of capitalism in Russia and China, wherever you see that as happening, you know, there's a century where socialism and communism strode the world and contended in the world of ideas and in the realm of armies. And now when a living and revolutionary communism appears, you know, and you all live in the same planet I do, it's either in very remote corners where semi-feudalism is still the issue of the day, in the Himalayas, in the Andes, in rainforests, or else it's in the radical dreams of revolutionary intellectuals. And the argument in the society is that that's the end of communism, that it's something that has run its course. And I think that we should find a way to affirm that it's a beginning that has real aspects to it. In other words, you don't often get the chance to reintroduce yourselves. A second chance. There's a whole generation that really is not imbued with much about communism at all, except the fact that it was a nice idea that failed, or it was a bad idea that failed because of the, you know. And so there's actually a, you know, what Mao calls a blank slate element to this. And I think we should seize that as an opportunity. I think this is a moment for an accounting. We can look back through these things. We can work through for ourselves a new form of presentation. You know, dry up the rivers of blood that were, you know, that existed, you know, decades ago, but have no relevance for us now, and retool the communist project, which involves a radical re-metabolizing of our experiences, in my opinion, and part of that is not just that the communist project has gone through an arc. You know, or several arcs with, you know, stages. But I mean, certainly a very clear arc over the last century. But also the world has changed in very radical ways. You know, I was, I've been doing a deep study of the Civil War for all kinds of reasons. And one of the things that struck me a couple days ago, which I hadn't understood before, is at the beginning of the war, they start talking about the Union because they think of themselves as a union of states. By the end of the war, Gettysburg Address is an example, they're talking about a nation. So what had gone into this war as an entity thinking of itself as states emerges from the war as a nation. It's a capitalist process that's going on. And I think on a world scale, we're going through a similar process where people have been thinking about bourgeois nation states. I mean, the multinational empires have broken up. People have been congealing into bourgeois nation states for 200 years. And that's becoming outmoded in ways we're barely starting to grasp. The economy is interwoven. The culture is spread. The languages are, you know, the languages are spreading in ways that didn't exist before. And how we, and first of all, that's an ex. So even our word internationalism implies that you're sort of rooted in a country and then you think beyond it. But it's now possible in a historic way for people, I mean in practical politics, I mean 10-year-old kids, to think about the humanity as an entity and our goals and our approach being worldwide. That's a huge change which should be incorporated fundamentally into our approach. Not to say there's not uneven development or revolution won't happen country by country, but even a discussion of socialism in one country, you know, which some people think was a settled question one way or the other in the 30s, has to be reapproached again. I mean, what would that mean? And what, you know, how does the economy now work? How is our culture? How will these ideas skip? You know, look at North Africa and the Middle East, how ideas and revolution can skip across borders and then mutate under local conditions in ways. You know, that's happened before, but needs to be assimilated now. So, I think two things in that approach, which sets this, my stage for even discussing Badiou briefly. I think we should do that kind of a project with a very particular mix. I think we should affirm for ourselves the need for an extremely radical communism in the most sweeping sense. I mean, the world needs to be transformed consciously in ways that are profound. And then we should do that. We should approach that in a way that is extremely contemporary and non-dogmatic. We should shed iconography. We should shed jargon. We should shed settled verdicts that don't justify themselves any longer, and actually set about having a discussion amongst ourselves and then with those who will be our audiences about how to transform these conditions that are so intolerable for us. Part of that is there are stages to the development of Marxism. I think Marx and Engels started with an extremely open system. I think, you know, I've thought about this from a number of different sides, but when you read their writings in the 19th century, they were wide open to what was happening around them. Darwin, Morgan, you know, learning from the British political economists, learning from the utopian French socialists, living in the world of German philosophy. This was an accretion, a synthesis out of the advanced thought of its time. And many positive things happened through the socialist experiences of the 20th century. But one of the negative things is that the requirements of state and even the requirements of popularizing communist ideas in a socialist country. I mean, all of a sudden you have a state, you have to teach kids things in school. There comes a codification of Marxism that accumulates an accretion, almost like barnacles, all kinds of verdicts and forms, and, you know, now dialectical materialism is this, and our view of how history develops is that, and these things become fixed in a way that we really, and in that sense, you know, I appreciate Badiou's thing about going back to the first period. I think we should shed that. I think we should shed it radically. You know, I think we should you know, not assume these things are settled questions, inevitability or stages of communism or just a million, you know, I am well trained in Marxism-Leninism, you know, in a way that, that those of you who are under 40 may not appreciate. And I'm just saying, you know, there are things to learn critically about those summations, but it doesn't suit what we're, it doesn't suit the storm we are going into. So, and for that reason, the Kasama Project, which I'm part of, really only has one common agreement. That we had a conference in April, and we agreed on one sentence. We are communists, and we believe in the forcible overthrow of all existing conditions. So rather than starting with the movement is everything and the final goal is nothing, all we have is the final goal. And we're actually seeking to think through the forms of movement which are really yet to be invented in some ways. And here are some examples of that. We think that the strategies for making revolution in a country like this are unknown. You know, it's an uncharted course. There have been many attempts. You know, I've been part of it. You know, there were generations before us. The Wobblies were part of it, if you know what I'm saying. But really, nobody has solved these problems, and the world is changing underneath our feet. We tried it in the 60s. You know, I mean, you know, there's a whole discussion that we can have about attempts people have done. The Black Nationalists tried it in their approach. You know, I'm just saying there are things to assimilate, but it remains a work in front of us, even as the world is changing. And then there's a whole other cluster of things which have to do with thinking through what socialist transition means. Not to disagree in a nitpicking way with Chris, but I don't think Badiou says that the party state was an experiment that failed. I think he thinks that it was an idea that has become exhausted. In other words, I think that there were breakthroughs on a world scale under those conditions, and this is what they did. And now we sit back and say, okay, now we're, you know, and in a certain sense, I think it was fine. I don't know what anyone thinks they should have done. You know what I mean? And that's a whole discussion. But on the other hand, here we are now. And if we don't have a different approach to popular agency, and if we don't have a different approach to internationalism or planned economy, you can build, you know, if you know the Russian Empire was in ruins, you can build a functioning planned economy if you're starting from zero. You can't take over this economy and plan it in any of the same. I mean, you're coming at those problems with those ideas. You're just not even in the ballpark. You're just making a religious game about things. So, and then also, just to raise some other things which I think are posed in a radically different way. For most of human history and for most of the revolutionary project, accumulating things was part of the problem. You know what I mean? I mean, peasants in China did not eat much. Establishing an industry, you know, was part of the process. We're actually, and for a lot of the world, I mean, trust me, I understand for half of the world that is still the case. We're actually dealing, and that has to do with the problems of sustainability and ecological destruction. We're dealing with a different side of the problem, where our social process has to be to develop a higher quality of social life in a world of solidarity, in a society that's been cannibalistic and dog-eat-dog, to actually provide meaning for people and connectivity in a place where capitalism has atomized people. And then the things, they take place on a different scale. I mean, you have to have a lower BTU consumption in the future of the United States. You know what I mean? I mean, the United States used twice as much BTUs per person as Europe. I mean, if we're not talking about fewer things on a certain level. And how will society package that process in a way that actually is emancipatory, and we're going to destroy imperialism. We live in a place that robs the world. How are we going to destroy imperialism and have people embrace the impacts of that? You know, I mean, you know, where did that come from? So you know what I'm saying? So I think a huge part of that is actually a different ethos, a different connection between the communist project and things and production that we have to work through and think about, that involve both problems of conception and problems of presentation. So, since we're talking, and just one final point about that, I was just thinking in the last panel, I was hearing people talk about classic revolutions and so on. Without being polemical in relationship to that panel, I don't think there's anything classical. I don't think there are classical revolutions. I don't think there are works of theory that are classical. I don't think there are models for revolution. I think it's been far too much of a problem. I think revolutions are like snowflakes. Once you get into them, they are radically different. Their forms, the expectations of people, the ideological morphings that happen. And if we go into it with a view of classic and model, there's something, you know, a fixed form. I mean, and I'm not implying that somebody thought that, but I mean, if you go into these things with fixed forms, you will miss it and not be able to do it. So with that, let me just segue briefly to a discussion of Badiou, because, well, you know, I think we stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, I mean, I'm not a post-Maoist. I am a Maoist. You know what I mean? I mean, every thought we have involves a negation, but I also think we should really embrace and understand, you know, what has been done. And I don't think it's in the form of models. I think it's in the form of methods. Mao took a theory that was totally alien to his environment and built something that really transformed China. And I don't know if people haven't been into that experience, but, you know, he was lucky he was in Yunnan. He refused to listen to the Comintern. They were telling him to do this and this. He just didn't do it. He did something else. He said, you know, and all of these revolutions were forged in the process. The Bolsheviks weren't forged so much in the underground, but they were forged in the Civil War. You can't understand Stalin if you don't understand the Civil War. That's when they were transformed. And the same thing is true in China. The communist project was reforged in Yunnan. It was something, there had never been anything like this before. The Yunnan process was something new, and it echoed on before. And the Cultural Revolution in its own way was the forging of something new. And I think, in part, that's one of the things that has attracted me to Badiou and, for example, his concept of the event. Because there really is a sense in that of the role of novelty. And of the difficulty of anticipating actual forms through which ideas emerge and sweep. So that if you try to prefigure these things, and there was a whole project we went through in the new communist movement of codifying things, polishing things, you know, elaborate programs for small groups of people, thinking on, you know, whether you were Trotskyist or Maoist is really irrelevant, you know, thinking that you were forging some sword and then the masses in the frenzy of a crisis would realize you were right all along and would wield it, you know, which is a nice idea, but it's actually not how things work. And in fact, when I was a kid, the old leftists hated the 60s. Everything about them was not how they wanted it to be. They didn't like the black nationalism. They didn't like us fucking. They didn't like the way we talked. They didn't like that we smoked pot. They didn't like our view of authority. They thought we were unapologetic about our communism. They just didn't like anything about it. They've been working for 20 years for a revolution, and here this comes, and look at them. They're freaks. You know what I mean? There's a lesson in that, because you can't anticipate the novel. And I think Badiou raises the question of an event that I think is an important supplement to our Leninist view of conjuncture. And our view of conjuncture, at least, you know, in the history I come out of, is steeped in a materiality. You know, it's a sense of the eruption of crises within the material substratum of capitalism, economic crisis, war, you know what I mean? And the view that, you know, it's sort of the base superstructure dichotomy, and it bubbles up from these forms, and then there's a breaking of hegemony in the superstructure and an opening up. And I think, you know, we've had our revolutions as the result of world wars. There's a real truth to it. I'm not, you know. But I think what Badiou brings to it is, and his theory of the event is a sense of how contagious new ideas erupt, how they come from a seeming void, how they have a novelty to them that you can't anticipate, how they, you know, how it's like sprays of antimatter that are coming out of these hoses and corroding that which is exhausted and which is corrupt and which has to go. And there's a sense here as a meditation on how shocking new truths forge cadre and sweep the field. And I think that's been missing from our communism, and I think it's actually a key part of how, you know, we Maoists talk about hasten and await. In other words, when Mao was in Yan'an, he couldn't form an army of 10 million to take China. But the Japanese had invaded. So he said, I'm hastening and awaiting. Hastening in the sense that I'm doing my work, I'm building my forces, and I'm awaiting the Japanese to be defeated on a world scale. You know, and in a sense, we hasten things, and then we await some changes that help things roll our way. That's a political project for you. And I think Badiou's sense of these things enlarges what we understand by hastening. And I think it enlarges what we understand by await. In ways, I'm not, you know, we can go there sometime. You know what I mean? But I think that's an example of it. And if we look at how the revolutions happen, often when they are written backwards, I think the history of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is an example of terrible history written backwards, so that everything seems inevitable, everything went in place, every plan they had foresee the events, and actually, it's a lie. It's not how it worked at all. And the sensibilities of the Bolsheviks with their shaved heads and their black leathers and their strange modernity was a negation of Tsarism. I mean, it didn't come from some other Marxist place. It came organically out of that society. You can't, you know, if you know, the Black Panther Party was the form that communism took in the United States. You know what I mean? Not these inventions that the CP was trying to do. So I think there's a sense in which this that we have to embrace this kind of novelty of the moment. And also, I think some of the more elaborated ways that Badiou gets into those things. Let me just give some other examples. So part of what I'm saying is there's no back to Marx here. There's no back to Lenin. It's not like there's some primordial communist theoretical moment that if we go back in a fundamentalist way and really get it, then we'll then be able to do something now. That's not how the world works. It's not how our theory works. And I'm really, and this is just a personal, I'm not interested in discussing who's the real Marxist. I'm really much more interested in discussing what do we believe and what are we going to do in a way that's illuminated by that material. I mean, I'm not talking about negating it, but I'm talking about here and now, you know, and not. And if you approach Marx without that, you'll end up being a bourgeois democrat. In other words, Marx's conception of Marx was writing at the very earliest creak of dawn for the communist revolution, where the world, you talk about Lincoln, where the world is subsumed by the bourgeoisie striding it as a young crowing cock, you know what I mean? And he's trying to imagine threads within that of socialism, and how it emerges out of the web of bourgeois society and out of its ideals in the French Revolution. And look, if, you know, if we take those moments and try to apply it now in this decrepit post-era of capitalism, we'll misunderstand, you know, the particularity of his moment. So let me just go here, just skip some things. Let me just talk about a couple other things just that I personally found relevant about Badiou. One is the concept of doing politics as distance from the state. All right, I think there's a world of politics that thinks that you get knee-deep, neck-deep in the corrupt politics of working for reforms and city councils and backing Barack Obama and being a left pressure within the Democratic Party and a million things, and then wake up one day and are just part of the fucking over of humanity. You know what I mean? I see people every day who say, okay, well, they're slaughtering people overseas, but we have benefits that are under attack too. And if you really think about it, if you're willing to acknowledge the slaughter overseas, if your benefits can be taken care of, that's the definition of corruption and really not knowing what time it is. So, you know, I think there's value in his approach of politics at distance from the state, by which he doesn't mean just the state apparatus in a classic Marxist sense, but the state of things. And I you know, we're engaged in the Kasama project of thinking through, you know, ways of engaging in deep political practice that we can do, which are spheres in which that are not automatically dominated by the state of things. For example, The life and survival and justice for undocumented workers is simply not addressed in the standard political. All kinds of things are addressed about them, but their situation is simply not addressed. And in some ways, if one takes those things up as distant from the state, it's possible to conduct a revolutionary politics and it was true in Mississippi in 1963 too. You know what I mean? Nobody was talking about it until they talked about it themselves. The other thing is there's a discussion of a topology of points. And, you know, my time's about up, so I'm going to wrap it up. But I think most radicals have no sense of real politics. I'm closely involved in studying events that are happening in Nepal, where this extremely radical party is agonizing over how to seize power. It's got an army that's there that they can't defeat. It has complex political scenes. They don't want to seize as a small minority and then point their guns at everybody. They think that's a bad approach. And so they're agonizing in public. And I find most people have no idea how to even read that discussion. And I think Badiou has a discussion of what he calls a topology of points. Points, in his case, are crossroads political decisions in a sequence of situations. I don't want to get into his jargon here. But then he perceives a topology that emerges out of these key line struggles in a living political process in a three-dimensional way. And I think, without endorsing everything he writes on that, I think that political radicals in this country have been doing propaganda and study for so long that we have zero sense of real politics. What it means to seize power, what it means to think about economics, what is planning, you know, who do you jail, who do you not jail, who do you ally with, who do you neutralize, how do you approach complex questions. I had a debate argument with somebody who said we should come out strong against circumcision. I said, how are you going to seize New York without Jews? You know what I mean? It's like, well, cutting the head of a penis is wrong. I said, well, it's their ritual. I mean, the revolution, they can't have an anti-Jewish plank. What's, you know what I mean? But I'm just saying, it was a, you know,
or it's Muslim. Muslim. Yeah, it's also Muslim.
It's Muslim. I said that. We had to hope, trust me. But I understand that. But I'm just saying, you know, it's a funny story. But I mean, I'm just saying, really, people are not thinking that way. People are actually not thinking that way, and actually thinking about politics. You know, how do we get there? You know, with real people, is a big part of it. And I'm just saying, in the breaking up of encrusted political thinking, I've been coloring inside the lines of Marxism-Leninism for 30 years, and I think it has real value. I mean, probably more than a lot of people here. I think I zoom out. But Badiou is like somebody was working in the next row in the vineyard. He's not bound by any of that. He's not coloring inside of those lines. And I just find it interesting and valuable that how he's been approaching those things. He doesn't feel like... And the man is schooled in Marxism. He knows what... You know, he's highly schooled in schools of Marxism. He comes out of a Maoist experience. But he's just not choosing to express himself that way. He's running a communist thought process. Okay. I can wrap it up at any point. But that's what I'm thinking is the connection between what we're doing and actually changing things. And I think there's real value in the cross-fertilization with people who are not working within the frameworks that a lot of leftist politics has been confined to.
Show them up.
Yep.
Okay. All right. You're going to give me time?
Yeah, sure. 15 minutes?
Great.
Yeah, because we've got 45 minutes.
No, I want to leave discussion because my remarks here, I mean, I had something else written. I wrote this morning. But I definitely want to get in more, engage Chris's position more, but hopefully I'll save that. I'm not going to go ad lib after just writing this morning. So I would like to begin by thanking the Affiliated Society and the organizers of this conference. I don't have all your names, but I know it's a lot of work, as well as Chris Catrone for organizing this panel and inviting us to speak with you today. I do not at all take it for granted that there are groups of people, in this country in particular, who come together to share views and engage in thoughtful discussion about capitalism, communism, Marxism, and paths to human emancipation. While the ravages of this capitalist system inevitably provoke resistance and opposition and fight back against this or that latest crime, abuse, or injustice, where there is oppression, there is resistance, as Mao said, the collaborative cultivation of communist ideas and space for those ideas is something else, something that takes conscious effort and savvy and care. As Badiou points out, and it is a point that informs his work broadly, unlike Marx's day, and I think here I do differ with Chris in terms of the need to historicize the state of idea or even utopia, we cannot take it for granted that a communist, let alone a communist workers' movement, aiming at the radical abolition, overthrow, and transformation rather than the mere amelioration or reform of the existing capitalist system exists at all. Ours is an age and the U.S. a society where the very existence of what Badiou calls the communist hypothesis, or at least the discussion of it, is in no way guaranteed. And so it is important that we not take forms like this and not take one another, our fellow travelers along this road, however far we may go together and when we may part on one question or another, for granted. So. The panel description asks several questions. They're certainly not exhaustive of the topic of Badiou, Maoism or post-Maoism and communism, but they do seem to be a good place to start. As a participant in the Kasama Project, I have developed an appreciation for processes that deepen and that unpack questions, complex questions, rather than coming to quick verdicts that often fail to engage the multiple layers of logic, assumption, evidence, and interpretation that are involved in whatever is the subject matter at hand. The problem with reaching and issuing quick verdicts, whether about the nature of the Soviet Union in the 30s or China in the 60s or about the historical legacy of Maoism or Trotskyism, we'll talk about later, right, or anarchism, or the philosophy of Slavoj Žižek or Alain Badiou, is not only, the problem with that is not only objective that such verdicts fail to do justice to the multiple aspects of the matter at hand, but also subjective, namely that unless we delve more deeply into the layers of our subject, rendering explicit and then problematizing and engaging underlying assumptions coming from what appear to be various sides of a particular issue, then we fail to create the possibilities for true understanding, for principled and productive struggle, mutual transformation, and collective reconception. We talk past each other and either fall into sectarian squabbles or paper unity that lacks a solid foundation. Bringing together radicals, Marxists, revolutionaries, or people from other trajectories within the United States, both through common practical work and protracted theoretical struggle, is, I would argue, a precondition for the reconception that is then a prerequisite for honest-to-God regroupment of the revolutionary forces in this country. And, you know, I appreciate Platypus's role in trying to make space for that. Kusama, at its best, strives to make a material contribution to the communist reconception and regroupment in the United States by maintaining and encouraging a space, or maintaining a space that encourages a better mode of discourse amongst radicals, socialists, Marxists, communists, and revolutionaries, and others. It is in this spirit that we have engaged the work of Alain Badiou. You can follow and engage this discussion, including an extended back and forth with Chris, for yourselves on the website. Perhaps some of you, actually, I'm just curious, have any of you checked that out? I'm curious people who have paid attention to that in particular. Okay. Rather than just dive in and give you an argument for the importance of the value of Alain Badiou, I think John may be taking that a little more directly. I want to use my time in part then to deepen and unpack and then perhaps address it. Just really, I was going to hope to do more than one, but one of the really quite jam-packed questions that were put to us by Chris and the Platypus Society for this panel. That's the first question. First, we are asked by the blurb for this panel, how does the prominence of Alain Badiou's approach to communism speak to the present historical moment and its emancipatory possibilities? It's a mouthful. This question, it's a good question. This question, like many questions, has embedded within it a number of aspects, at least four as I count it, right? The prominence of Alain Badiou, what is that? What is his approach to communism? And how does all of that relate to the present historical moment and its emancipatory possibilities? I count four. I mean, each of these, I mean, of course, they're interrelated. I guess you could probably come up with 15 or 16, right? If you each of these aspects brings forth another question, complex in and of itself, questions that deserve full treatment in themselves, and I'm just going to try to walk through a couple of them. One, how prominent is Alain Badiou's thought today, and what is the nature of this prominence? That is, who is reading him and who is not? Where are they located geographically, socially, politically, etc.? How many readers of what demographic does Badiou have, and how does that compare relatively with other philosophers or communists, contemporary or not? Žižek, Marx, Lenin, Mao. I will admit that I am not in a position to speak to this question with any degree of authority. Events where Badiou speaks, at least in places like New York City where I've seen him, seem to be well attended. Apparently, the idea of communism conference at Birkbeck in London about a year ago or so was featured, where Badiou was not the only, but a featured participant, drew over 1,200 people when they were only expecting 200, a sign of something. Certainly, Verso has been pumping out his books in translation. I mean, and yet, among many of my friends who are self-identified socialist activists, I don't sense that Badiou has to date had much impact at all, if they've heard of him. Mapping the influence and prominence of Badiou is a worthwhile project. In fact, I would like to use this opportunity today to take a quick straw poll in terms of this investigation. How many of you have read some Badiou seriously here today? How many people have read more than an essay? Have read a book? Okay. Shout them out. What books have people read? I'm just literally curious about this. Don't be shy.
Being an event.
Yeah.
Communist hypothesis. Yeah. Right.
I was under the impression that every Nepalese peasant.
Badiou has said that we should often think about the model of needing to teach. Actually, I don't want to. use that, you know, to teach math, higher mathematics to, what, to 8-year-olds, he said, right? Now, and I don't want to suggest the Nepalese or the Nepalese peasants is the 8-year-old analogy. But I think, you know, I think in this world of interconnectedness and the quick transformation and translation and of ideas, I wouldn't put it past. I'd be very interested to see if there's a Baidu study group in Nepal. But I don't know. Perhaps in the issue of Q&A, when we get to Q&A, we can talk a little bit about where and by whom a Jew is appearing and through whom in our various fields. To what use is he being put and by whom? You know, and I just don't want to assume that, and this gets into a point I will make down below, that there is just one Baidu, one influence. I think I want to think about how do we concrete that, how concretize that, because it may be, you know, and what is the practical role that engaging with Baidu is playing in different circumstances in the academy. And at a minimum, we can say his rise to prominence to some degree would seem to be a signal to a growing openness to the issue or the question of communism, at least, or at least a radical questioning of capitalism, which is to say a waning of a certain Cold War era prohibition, a fading maybe perhaps of a certain end of history, Fukuyama haze that has blanketed at least academia for so long. Another sign I like to put out here of the times, perhaps not related to Baidu so much, a recent Rasmussen poll. I buckled down and actually subscribed to Rasmussen. I'm a gold member so that I can get the detailed demographic information of these bourgeois pollsters. But they publicly put out the finding that 11% of people, likely voters,
had read Baidu.
What's that? No, 11% think that a communist system would be more moral than the system we have now. Only 4% think it would work better. But that, of course, likely voters tend to be richer, and you know you can do all kinds of demographic analysis. But this is one thing they didn't put in the publicly available poll that I got through the Rasmussen numbers as a gold whatever member for $15 a month. It's 26-27% among 18-29-year-olds, and that goes for the how does it work question as well. Now, I mean, what does it mean? What do they associate with communism?
Also, the tone of question.
Oh, certainly. Right, there's like, all kinds of, but most of the things
what
we tend
do you
to,
think of socialism?
It was communism. This was communism. The numbers for socialism have been higher, right? But I want to, you know, put that out there. I mean, we can analyze that, interpret it. We talked a little bit about it on Kasama. I posted the numbers there, I guess to go back to Baidu, to what extent does Baidu or the discourse around the idea of communism in academia and elsewhere, to what extent has that contributed to this support or openness to communism? And to what extent has it just merely benefited from it? You know, that is to say, people are just, because of the crisis that capitalism faces, people like Baidu are just getting more attention, right? If it wasn't Baidu, it would be someone else. You know, I'm not prepared to resolve that question, but I want to raise it. Now, at this point, so that's the first question. I mean, the question of his prominence. I want to think about what is really going on there. How are these ideas in the text, and which ones circulating and not? I mean, and this leads into this is significant for, among other reasons, because of this next aspect. What is Alain Baidu's approach to communism? It's a big one, right? It's a big question. I would start by noting an assumption that's built into this question, and I don't fault the question writers as part of putting together a blurb, namely that there is only one singular Baiduist approach to communism. While I haven't yet made a thorough reading, or a reading, let alone a close study of Baidu's complete oeuvre, I have read enough to learn that there is more than one Baidu, if you will, as there is more than one Marx, that there are tensions, competing trajectories, and changes that move throughout Baidu's work, certainly going back to the 60s, but even more recently going from the 80s to today. Now, I'm not trying to introduce some kind of post-structuralist, like postmodern kind of BS, like there's so much Baidu, you can't say anything coherent about him and so forth. I'm not trying to go that way. But I do think there are some distinct trajectories that are worth distinguishing. For instance, just to give one example, I mean, Bruno Bastille's recent essay, The Leftist Hypothesis, which is in The Idea of Communism. This is the book that was put out, but you know, based on, a lot of them are much more developed, but based out of the conference that I alluded to earlier in Birkbeck. He makes the point there that that even just looking at Baidu's work in the 1980s, and particularly in the theory of the subject, Baidu's attitude towards terms such as class struggle, the dictatorship of the proletariat, the party state, is distinctly different than what he is at least most often speaking about today, or certainly the most frequent attribution to him of statements like the exhaustion of the party in state form and so forth. To be fair, to come back to Mike's point, you know, just to clear up a little bit, or perhaps at least give a little textual basis for a disagreement that's already emerging here between Chris and Mike on the question of Badiou's view of the state, I will read a little bit from the end of the meeting of Sarkozy, where Badiou, after discussing the first sequence of revolution, turns to the second and does talk about the limitation he sees the state, in particularly in China, but also in the Soviet Union, have. And he says, here, the second sequence of revolution, right, of communism, in its turn, created a problem that it lacked the means to resolve by the very methods that had enabled it to resolve the problem handed down by the first sequence. The party, in fact, appropriate for insurrectionary or military victory over weakened reactionary powers, proved ill-adapted for the construction of a state of proletarian dictatorship in Marx's sense. In other words, a state organizing the transition towards a non-state, a power of non-power, a dialectical form of the withering away of the state. Right. So I just wanted to put that out there. I didn't plan to bring in that quote, but just a couple minutes. In that, it's more dialectical than just saying, and more historicized than saying it just failed. Or it was not saying that it was a wrong path, right? I mean, without that path being forged, new problems that now are facing us wouldn't have emerged at all, right? And I think yet the problems that they came across weren't decided in advance. This is where I would go with Mike on this. It's not just that they didn't do the classical version of a revolution or something like that that accounts for those problems. There's a lot of contingency, a lot of specific historical and political detail and conjunctures that need to be examined to understand exactly how these limits on the party state, if you will, played out. So there's more than one Badiou, even dealing with something like the party state. And you can look elsewhere, and in fact, it's interesting, in the Communist Hypothesis book, Badiou republishes an essay from his kind of more Maoist or immediate post-Maoist phase when he's still very much talking the language of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. And there it's still very, waxes optimistic. He gives a little qualifying note in italics before the essay, but talking about this essay just speaks to the need and the failure in May 68 for a certain kind of party of a new type, a Maoist party of a new type based in the mass line to develop there. So there's a lot of... So, I mean, Badiou's thoughts about the state have evolved and are still evolving. And, in fact, even after the idea of communism conference, we see in the full version of his essay written up and also published in Communist Hypothesis, we see that Badiou... he's himself kind of qualifying his claim about the exhaustion of the party state. I'm not sure if he's paying attention to what's going on in Nepal or what. He's not really explicit about what's driving it. It may just be the struggle that happened in the conference at the idea of communism. But he talks about the fact that it may be possible for the revolutionary subject to have a vision of it, still be organized around an alternate vision of a state. As long as that state, that vision, that figure of the state has within it the figuring of, embedded in its very concept, the withering away of the state, right? So he's going very much back to a kind of, Leninist of state and revolution type concept. So I mean, there's flux in Badiou, and I think he deserves sustained reading, not kind of selective, identification of his worst moments and kind of knocking him down on that basis. Because if the field of Badiou in his own, the terrain of his texts themselves are kind of layered and complicated and nuanced and evolve over time, so the readership of Badiou and the interpretation of Badiou is even more so complicated, and we need to do a close study of that terrain in order to intervene in it productively. Just to close, I don't mean to wade too deeply into this particular and important thicket of the party state at this point, although I hope that we can get into it in the question and answer. I also do want to say that I find Bastille's essay in this book to be particularly provocative on the question and useful. I just wanted to make the basic point that both historically and even in our present moment, Badiou's thinking is an active and developing process, one that, as Bastille has suggested, is still subject to the pressure and effect of ideological struggle. And I think that if we want to wade into these struggles, that we ought to familiarize ourselves with the terrain to a degree, maybe perhaps a greater degree than we have at this point. I'm not going to get a chance to do that stuff from Sarkozy, but I do want to make a closing point, which is that I'm going to take a little issue with. I think the characterization of communism for Badiou, as Chris has framed it, Badiou does use the term the Kantian regulatory ideal, but I don't see it as a norm or as a utopian horizon. Rather, Badiou, in the meaning of Sarkozy, for instance, refers to it as a heuristic, which is to say, a means for evaluating contemporary, actually existing practice and ideas. A test, which is to say, could this lead, or does this existing practice or idea bar the path to global human emancipation? It's more of a negative means of evaluating actually existing practices or proposals. And it's not so much, it's not a positive content. You know what I mean? I think it's a means for evaluating what is on the table right now. Similarly, the very notion, I almost feel like the idea of communism itself, as he talks about it, is a bit of a misnomer. It's much more of an operation, he talks about it. You know, it's an operation, a projection, perhaps even a project, not a fixed utopian ideal. And this will be very much the final point. What I see is very useful in Badiou is not just that his insistence on keeping fidelity to these ideas in dark times, you know, until the next event or sequence emerges or the prospect of it does, but that there's coincident with this emphasis on the idea, there's an imperative to study the actually existing concrete struggles that are going on now, including, you know, the ways in which examples of successful partial or relative success infusing intellectual work with the masses of people in the super slums that are developing around the world, even where these movements are not taking a particularly liberatory or left wing, let alone communist or Marxist form, right? Hezbollah and other groups, you know, his emphasis is on studying the particularities of practice. So alongside the idea, I think there is maybe a less pronounced theme in Badiou, which is an ethic of investigation and concrete investigation, both of historically existing revolutions and their particularities, and of contemporary movements, even those who don't present themselves as Marxist or communist, but which still may be have fragments of the that we can then help to synthesize our ideas as we move forward. Sorry for going over time. Thank you.
John Steele, 15 minutes.
Okay. Mine is entitled, Why is Badiou a Political Bustown? I assume we all start out from Marxism. I do. And what does this mean? There have been many Marxisms, and the way to deal with this fact, I believe, is not to somehow think we can excavate the true and only Marx, or Marxism, and then to proceed from that base, but to rather recognize the fact of many Marxisms, not only in history, but within Marx's writings themselves. I'm not going to go into that anymore. But leaving that aside, let's ask, why is Marx of political value, if I say that about him? Well, first, a point of clarification on politics. What I mean by that is the politics, to say it very broadly, of human emancipation. Given that that is our politics, our broad political aim, then what is of political value can be characterized equally valuable broadly as what conduces to or helpful to working towards the same. And obviously this will be historically relevant. So Marx is of political value if his works conduce towards this. And for quite a lot of the last 150 years, he has been thought to be valuable in precisely that way. Now, I won't go into that either. But for Badiou, my thesis is that for us, at this particular historical moment, that he and his writings and his public stance is of political value. That is, he speaks to our situation and the dilemmas of this historical moment in a way that I think can move us forward politically. Part of the reason for this value is, in fact, the fact that has been mentioned already, you know, that he does not pose his work as a development of Marxism. And I would claim Badiou for Marxism. And on the other hand, it's salutary to think, to find a thinker who defines himself politically in terms of communism, who traces a complex identity with all that communism has meant in the 20th century, but who does not seek to derive, deduce, or define a contemporary emancipatory politics simply in these terms, nor in the language, for the most part, of this tradition. And the reason why this is a good thing about Badiou is because this trajectory of revolutionary politics, along with much of his language and terminology, is dead. Dead, that is, in the sense of being a living force in the world, socially and politically. Now, on one hand, Marx is an intellectual and political resource, as is Lenin and many other revolutionary thinkers. And it would be unthinkable for any contemporary emancipatory politics to attempt to do without this resource. But to say that Marx, or other people too, is a necessary resource for rebuilding is clearly not to say that Marxism is a living political force or social force. It was, and it was a living movement with a broad commonality of thinking and acting in the political realm, what Badiou calls a subject pursuing the truth process. This no longer exists. And the point at present, I think, is not to resuscitate or resurrect what is dying. Now, before moving on to Badiou and talking about his political value, I want to talk about a couple of his key concepts. First of it is the event. And I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding of this, because an event, a Badiouan event, which a technical term in his thinking, is a momentary break in a ruling or hegemonic structure of things, an opening out of which a new truth process, which I'll get into in a minute, may be born. It is, he says, the creation of new possibilities, not the realization of an already existing possibility, but the creation of new possibilities. And I'll come back to that in a minute. A truth process. Now, Badiou likes to define politics in terms of truth process. And he says, in fact, that politics, or a particular political sequence, is a truth process. That is, that was something which is a process which forges its own truths. And in this word, this phrase, again, I'll get back to this. Both terms are notable and important, both truth and process. But after a certain point, the truth process becomes what he calls saturated, and in effect, it reaches an impasse. And this is what he believes has happened with the sequences that went from, on the one hand, from the 1871, or rather began from there, and then the sequence that began from 1917. Okay, so these are what I would call the beneficially destructive aspects of Badiou's thought. That is, and to sum that up, I think that what is salutary here is the emphasis on the autonomy of politics. And I'm not completely sure whether, and a lot of this, what I want to try to say about Badiou is you can find him politically valuable without saying this is, you know, the answer. That this is a structure of thought, a system, which is something that should be substituted for others, or something, or anything of the sort. You know, in fact, I don't know if he's completely true in terms of his great emphasis on the autonomy of politics. But what is valuable is this emphasis, I think. Why? Because it helps to pry us loose from a century or 150 years of making, or trying to make, politics an appendage of something else. Of economics, often, or of philosophy. And this illustrates a prominent way in which he can be politically valuable, because he outlines a new grand theory. And in fact, I think if you look at his people who are fans or students or acolytes, if you will, of Badiou, in fact, that's not the attitude that's usually taken. If you look at any of the prominent people who write on Badiou, such as Peter Hallward or Bernabas Steels, they're not disciples of Badiou, you know, but yet they're profoundly influenced by his system of thinking and are trying to forge something on that basis, but not by taking it as a dogmatically at least. but what I think is valuable here is in making possible a new approach. Which will, at the very least, and this is something that Badiou accomplishes in this destructive aspect, challenging well-worn and habitual left platitudes, which have shown themselves by this point to be sorely unfruitful. Now, what about truth? He stresses truth, and he likes to say it's politics of the truth process. Why? Why is that valuable, my topic? Well, he says... He says that any real politics is constituted by a truth process. Now, first of all, let's take the second term first. Politics is process. That is not an achieved or hoped for result, and not a process based on recipe or body of knowledge, at least not knowledge taken as knowledge, so to speak, which I'll get into a bit more in a second. Rather, it's a process beginning not from what exists or from the knowledge of what is, but from, as he proposes it, an axiom, as an axiomatic beginning. Now this axiomatic beginning is taken up as a starting point in view of an event, which I'm going to come back to now. An event, in Baudieu's rather technical sense, is not a grand happening. It is not even a noteworthy thing that occurred. It is rather more like a little flicker, which might easily pass unnoticed, and which will pass unnoted in the historical annals unless it becomes the beginning of a truth process. And Baudieu believes that events happen all the time. What does not happen is that they get that somebody has the perception or the courage to take them up and to actually make them the beginning of something else, which is a very risky process. An event gives a momentary glimpse, not of possibilities inherent in what exists or in history, but to repeat, a glimpse of the possibility of possibilities. In the axiomatic beginning of a truth process, the taking of a stance, it is to assume that these possibilities are real, or even more, to explore the world and to act as if these possibilities will have become true. Thus, politics, actual emancipatory politics, is a leap in the dark. It is not action based on what we know or what can be known. It is action based on a gamble, on the making of a very serious bet, not even on a possibility, but on what would be the case if the implications of that initial glimpse of the possibility of what might be are followed out and made true. To take up a political truth process is to assume that after that axiomatic beginning in practice, to take it up fully and follow out its implications. That is to act on a supposition of what will become true given the axiom's truth, if the axiom were true, which you're taking it as true. This is not a toe-in-the-water attitude. It's not a testing it out to see whether it works stance. It's a leap which can only be made with courage and confidence, a confidence which cannot be founded in the world which surrounds the one who leaps. So we can clearly see the process part, and we can also start to see what's meant by truth here. But Baudieu makes a strong distinction between knowledge and truth. Knowledge, in his terms, is what is achieved and relates solely to an existing state of affairs. Truth, on the other hand, is always processual, always in process, never achieved, else it changes to knowledge. The reference of truth is in a future perfect, as he sometimes says. Truth only reaches a state of achievement retrospectively. Okay. Now, also associated with a truth process is what Baudieu calls a subject. And a subject for him is, just to clear up a possible misunderstanding, not an individual person of consciousness, but something trans-individual. Baudieu describes the subject as a new body constituted by the trace of an event and oriented around a truth process. That's a big topic, which I'll leave aside. Okay, the political value. The concept of event is what's most often taken from Baudieu, and it's important. But there's much more to Baudieu than simply the admonition to be on the lookout for what is new. There is this admonition. It's understood with sufficient openness. what we're on the lookout for is the possible beginning of a new truth process, not something we're calling on to conform to an already existing political template. A good place, by the way, recently to see how this works for Badiou and very concretely is to see, you know, some of his recent remarks about the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, which have been reprinted on the website which I moderate, which is Kashuri, which I have some, if you want to pick up a bookmark, and Kasama. Okay. Marxism, as it has existed, has built politics upon a theory of history, within which socialism becomes the proximate revolutionary goal and communism is over the horizon, but nonetheless a state of things to be achieved. In this context, politics becomes or can become an activity which is both teleological, guided by a particular goal to be achieved, and instrumental, the process serving as an instrument to the achievement of this goal. Badiou's conception is a challenge precisely to this. Communism, and I'm trying to state what Badiou, I believe, is saying, communism is imminent within the process of emancipatory politics, an axiom, not an objective, a process, not a program. The communist hypothesis, as he calls it, informs the political truth process, not as a plan or program, nor as a goal, but as the general and overriding defining axiom. Communism, no, not socialism, another question. Communism as axiom and process, I think, restores real contingency to politics and cuts against the pragmatic orientation. This process is not a strategically mapped out march toward a pre-established goal, but an aleatory process, as he says sometimes, that is following a necessarily chance-ridden path. In fact, I would say, I think Mike made this point, isn't this how revolutionary politics has actually proceeded, no matter how it's conceived itself? But, I mean, I think that has been true in the past in terms of the actual political process of revolutionary politics. But whether that has been true in the past or not, I think it would be hard to deny that any emancipatory politics of the present historical moment would be or must, if it's going to take place, fit Badiou's open but anchored process.
So I'm going to let each panelist respond for 2 minutes. Maybe we'll go in the order that they gave the presentations, and then we'll go to Q&A.
I kind of wanted to respond a couple of things. Just maybe underscore a point that I made that seems to have been sort of sidestepped, which is my accusation that Badiou is giving a mystified ontology of the operation of bourgeois society already. And the reason that I say that is very sort of particular. And that is, this is where it's situated in response to some of the other presentations, starting with Mike, the idea of the contradiction in capitalism that you know, cries out for change is between technical progress that has rendered oppression of some humans by other humans sort of superfluous and unnecessary. I think that you know, what that sort of sidesteps is what I would call a kind of regressive aspect of capitalism that I think that Marx identified. In other words, that Marx, after the Industrial Revolution, thinks that the operation of bourgeois society is no longer progressive, but actually sort of undermines itself in very particular ways. And what this means is that one can't sort of think about progress in politics as sort of improvement and development in the same way, but rather the recurrence of a problem, the repetition of a problem, and a kind of recurrent repetition of a problem that gets worse as it repeats itself. In other words, that we're stuck in a kind of post-industrial revolution world, a post-1848 world, in which the same tasks that presented themselves to Marx repeat themselves, but in worse form. Getting around to the question of Badiou as sort of bourgeois in that sense, you know, in my presentation I talked about the liability of the rebellion against capitalism to reproduce the forms of the constitution of capitalism, namely the revolt of the third estate, the struggle against inequality, because I would characterize, you know, quite differently probably from the others, I would characterize bourgeois society and capital as itself constituted by and reproduced by the struggle against oppression. In other words, I would say that the way the society keeps going, it's not like an ancient society that just maintains its forms, but rather the way the society keeps going is by constantly revolutionizing itself, constantly changing itself, and that it does so specifically through the forms of discontent that it generates, and that people find, like, in other words, where's the banana from? Where's the banana from? I don't think that the banana is from someone who went and stole it from a peasant in another country. I think it came from the peasant wanting to sell his labor. Right? In other words, I think that that part of it is also an important part of it, meaning the banana is here because someone in another country wants to participate in the global economy, and therefore we have bananas. And that if we neglect that, we neglect the way the society keeps going. In other words, the demand for labor, the demand to be put to work. The people in the shanty towns, the people in the slum cities, in the mega slums, what they want is to be able to sell their labor on the global market. And that is a constant force for the regeneration of capitalism, in Marx's view. In other words, it's not that it's emanating from New York or something, you know, okay, where are we going to get bananas? Right? It's that people in another country are like, you know, fuck, what do I have that's worth anything? You know, maybe I could sell bananas. Now, finally bringing it around on the issue of Marx, that Marx is a politics based on history that was teleological and instrumental. It might be the case that, in fact, Marxism is very bourgeois in that sense, meaning that it recognized a task given by history, and that that task remains sort of unfulfilled. You know, that this is, in a sense, you know, that Marxism thought that history had come to a certain point, and that if we didn't overcome a problem that history had presented, then society could degenerate as a result of not meeting that task. Whereas I think that what Badiou offers in saying that communism is a process and not a program or a goal is essentially a kind of communized version of the continuation of bourgeois society in perpetuity. And that he gives a very sophisticated philosophical account, I don't think nearly as sophisticated as a Hegelian dialectic, but some version of an account philosophically of how society can reproduce itself through contingency and through process and in an aleatory manner. I do think that, that capitalism thrives on the aleatory, in fact. It thrives on contingency. It is, in fact, the case that it was brought up in the RCP's presentation this morning that, of course, the capitalists, you know, in a sense, both in Japan and elsewhere, are hovering around the tsunami damage, and they're saying, you know, this is an opportunity for Japan to get out of its slump that it's been in for 20 or 30 years, right? Because it actually is. Like, it actually is an opportunity for that. And, you know, we would be remiss to neglect that kind of operation at a kind of social level of how capitalism regenerates itself. I think it regenerates itself through democratic discontents, the demand to be put to work, the demand to participate in the global economy. And all of that entails a struggle against oppression, the cry of the oppressed. And I'm not saying that those aren't important things. What I'm saying is that Marx understood how that becomes a self-defeating process after the Industrial Revolution, how that actually creates a sort of self-contradiction in society, that the way that we try to kind of overcome our oppression is essentially by rehashing the French Revolution over and over again, and that Badiou is entirely complicit in that. In other words, he basically says, the Spartacus revolt, Luther, you know, here I stand, I can do no other. You know, and maybe the friendlier version is the Thomas Munzer, the peasantry, as opposed to Luther, the crazed monk. But that essentially what Badiou gives us is, you know, in all of history, the oppressed have struggled against oppression and they've given us something new. But what he's giving us is the eternal emergence of bourgeois society, which I think will just lead to its perpetual continuation.
Yeah.
Okay. This you know, I believe you know, the RCP polemic, but also you know, Chris, you know, and others have accused or suggested that Badiou's radical democratic or radical his communist ideas, kind of radical egalitarianism or something, is kind of return to you know, French Revolution or the horizon of that. I mean, and you quoted a passage from the meeting, or at least from the meeting of Sarkozy to that effect, but you left out the key parts that actually, I think, distinguish his call and almost make it clear, at least in this text, that Badiou's vision of communism is more influenced by Marx or Mao or both than by, at least as much as by the French Revolution. You know, the communist hypothesis that a different collective organization is practicable, one that will eliminate inequality of wealth and even the division of labor, continues. Every individual will be a multi-purpose worker, put in quotes. And in particular, people will circulate between manual and intellectual work, as well as between town and country, right? So here we have the you know, the call, I mean, this goes back to Marx, this goes, but, you know, it's these things took very practical political form in the Chinese Revolution, you know, around the, you know, the Cultural Revolution in particular, you know, the need to overcome the division between manual and intellectual labor, the need to overcome the historically, you know, the opposition and the vast division and alienation between town and country. So I think, I mean, there's more, I think it seems to me to be...
Isn't that modern capitalism? Isn't what he's describing modern capitalism?
No, but I'm saying, but he's saying that, I mean, to me, I see there, you know, it's very similar to the kind of the dictatorship of the proletariat and so forth, some sort of agency beyond simply, you know, redistributing the wealth or expropriating the appropriators. There's going to need to be some sort of process by which, you know, the deformations of capitalism are overcome. And I mean, I'm sure Michael will speak to it more directly, but it seems to me, I mean, I feel like, some terms that are very key to Chris's argument need to be historicized. Like, I think it was in this paper, that maybe in the previous version, the Marxist hypothesis piece, where you talk about, you know, there being so many communists, but not many Marxists. But I look around, and that doesn't correspond to what I see around me. I think that the difference between you kind of invoke, I think, you know, properly, Marx, you know, did have a lot of critical things to say about the actual communist movement, you know, of his own time, or the social democratic movement, and the critique of Gotha program and so forth. He's like, can't you wait to form this, you know, collective, this new, you know, party until you read Capital? I mean, it's almost like the subtext of some of that. I mean, there's more to it than that, but... yes, but, I mean, his conditions, I mean, there were, you know, I think, both with respect to the very idea or the notion of communism and the idea of the idea, or if, you know, this isn't really Badiou's term, but utopia, I think that both of those concepts had very different valence and in social status, if you will, or significance and movement within Marx's day than they do today. You know, in particular, I mean, I think Badiou talks about, you know, in one of his more polemical pieces, talks about how, you know, all, you know, the kind of the focus on individualism and crass, cynical materialism in the bad sense of the term, you know, that the capitalism ideology pumps into people's, you know, heads, you know, can be boiled down to, you know, it kind of inverted into the concept to live without an idea. To live without an idea, you know, the idea that we're in this incredibly, I mean, Badiou kind of operate, you know, moves, I think, on the, at least in some of his more explicitly polemical writings, on the basis, you know, and this involves his critique of human rights discourse and so forth too, that the whole very idea of a positive, good idea, you know, a project is itself kind of under siege, or it's, and even people who are on the left still are operating in more of a mode of negativity, just opposing the harm being done, right? Ethics is just like to oppose harm being done to someone, as opposed to constructing some idea of the positive good, you know, here. So I think that it's important to historicize, you know, many things, including the status of the bourgeois state and so forth. I mean, I think Mike's point about the CIA, et cetera, I'm sure he'll pick that up in a minute. Like, I mean, I guess to turn into a question to Chris would be, what would, you know, reading the bourgeois revolutions, you know, or reading... the progressive nature of capital, what would that translate to in terms of political practice today? You know, I mean, and how would it deal with the kind of, you know, ecological crisis, the existence of this incredible capitalist, you know, state apparatus and imperialist apparatus that in some sense bars, you know, certain subjects from being able to actualize those democratic demands. I mean, I'd like to kind of pitch it back to you in terms of, you know, the practical, how that would be practically unfolded from that theoretical stance.
Well, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what to say here, because I think we're really in somewhat different valences. I mean, I really see Chris's standpoint as being one which is exactly what I believe Badiou is trying to get away from, and on a more sophisticated basis, but which is simply to say, you know, in effect, we have to understand Marx more deeply. And what if we do that, then we'll be on the right path. And I have respect for the depth of Chris's understanding of it, but I don't think that's a politically viable route to emancipatory politics. And to say Badiou is not a Marxist in that sense, it is, so to speak, trying to batter down an open door. So I feel as if this conversation is taking place on two very different planes.
Mm-hmm. Mike, did you want to?
I can cede my time to the question. That's fine. I don't have anything burning.
Go ahead.
First, I had a very brief statement. We were talking that some would bring up who reads Badiou. And as far as I can tell, the people who read Badiou are mostly left liberal academics. And the only real communist and Marxists who seem to take Badiou seriously are the people in this room, namely some Maoists, certainly. And obviously, he has this deep Maoist background, and Platypus. So it's Maoists, some Maoists, and Platypus. So I think it's interesting that all these liberals seem to be reading Badiou and essentially ignoring the Maoist background. That's one comment. The other thing that I wanted to ask is, it seems to me that part of the difference between Chris and everybody else in this panel is a radically different evaluation of the political significance of the 1960s for the left. Mm. That the people on this side are basically pro-1960s. You see the 1960s as a great moment in the history of the left. Whereas I think Chris would have a much more critical and negative perspective. So I'd like some, and I think that also plays into how one sees Badiou, because clearly for Badiou, the 60s are this epochal high point of the left.
Or an improvement. I think that's the real issue, is whether or not we're talking about a kind of progressive development and a kind of improvement that's taken place in the history of, like, in other words, to say that the party state didn't fail, but rather was exhausted. I think that that's interesting in a way, but it also kind of sidesteps the issue of whether there might have been some wrong turns. In other words, like, of course, I would want to redeem the experience of the Russian and Chinese Revolution, but that's something a little bit different from saying building off of it, right? I would want to redeem the sacrifices and make them worthwhile in some way. But I would also sort of say maybe the sacrifices weren't exactly necessary. In other words, that there were other possibilities. That in a sense, the return to Marx, I mean, it's not that I wanted sort of deeper reading of Marx exactly. It's because that would be, in a sense, not particularly political. The question is whether, progressive politics is still progressive, or whether politics is progressing in the present period relative to other periods in history, and whether we could analogize, like the way Badiou analogizes the post-1976 period with the 1871 to 1917 period. I think that progress was made between 1871 and 1917 in a way that you can't say progress has been made since 1976, or maybe even since 1968. I mean, that's just like prima facie obvious. I don't know that maybe that doesn't mean very much, but to me, it's why I'm interested in Lenin and why I'm not interested in Badiou, because I feel like, okay, Badiou is sort of giving us the post-68 experience. Lenin gave us the post-1871 experience. I find one more kind of compelling, interesting. I don't know. Does that mean that I have like a bibliographic fascination with it? No. It's really the question of history, and whether the history just becomes exhausted and sort of
you know, recedes, or whether history kind of comes back with a vengeance, you know, as tasks that are there but unfulfilled, whether they fester, you know, whether they kind of rot the present, which obviously is not like a kind of normal scientific approach to progress, because, you know, like, why not just start again? Why not just continue? Why not just pick up where we are now and try? What's going on?
We should end, unless you guys want to have the last one. Go ahead. Go take a last word.
Right. I'll just say a few things briefly. I'm not going to get into a whole defense of... I was in France in 1968, you know what I mean? I'm not going to get into a whole, you know, defense of that, but I do want to say one thing, and that is that socialism by then had become a rather gray and depressing experience. And when I was a teenager and saw high school students marching their professors with dunce caps through the streets of China, I thought, okay, I can get with that. And there was something new. And there was something, and once you
That's
get
a little gray and depressing, isn't it? Dunce caps?
Well, I thought not.
Marching in the streets.
I can sum it up now differently. You know, Mal actually thought it was a bad idea. But
it's like Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Well,
like
I have to say, it did look like fun at the time.
And I bet they deserved it. So, and it's something that's desperately missing in the world today. And I know a lot of people here are teachers, but I don't think you're wrong. But I think when you excavate the theoretical basis of it, you know, there's actually a lot of things in what Chris was just saying a moment ago that I would agree with. You know, for example, I don't think bananas are, you know, I mean, I don't think it's a crude act of theft. I think it's a very complex relationship. People don't go to shantytowns because their lives get worse there. They go because feudalism is collapsing and capitalism reassimilates them. I mean, it's, you know, we don't have a primitive view of imperialism. I do think, however, that it is important to understand how capitalism takes a horror and makes it a new horror. I mean, you know, we were talking about the bourgeois revolution there, and, you know, it didn't just come out of the class struggle of late medievalism. They had African slavery that made Rembrandt possible. You know, in other words, the rosy dawn point was completely missing in our discussion in the last panel. In other words, you know, capitalism incorporates these old forms and then grinds people up into powder. And I think the lesson of the Cultural Revolution was the degree to which our attempt... It was shocking to understand that capitalism could be restored in socialism. It was shocking the fragility of the basis on which Soviet and Chinese socialism rested. When Mao says 90% of our factories are capitalists, just go look at them. That was a shocking idea. I mean, there's a whole generation of socialists who would never have thought that. They thought, you know, and people, I knew people who said, look, socialism is like childbirth. Once it's squeezed out the canal, you can't stuff it back in. You know what I mean? And Mao's analysis is saying, look, we're hanging on by our hooks here, and capitalism is a huge engine that's underpinning a lot of what's going on here, and we have fragile socialist new things, and we need waves of revolution. These were theoretically shocking ideas. And I don't think you can understand the, you know, and it's often written out of the books, but I don't think you can understand the awakening of new emancipatory politics in many places. France, where we were, you know, the Black Panther Party, however you want to see it. It's, you know, SNCC and the civil rights movement arose in close relationship to the African liberation movement. China itself was an extension of the anti-colonial movement, and then you had this socialist, you know, explosion of a radical new idea where the head of the frickin' state goes down and says, bombard the headquarters. You know, I mean, this was a very different conception of what socialism required and needed, and also a statement of the fragility of how little had been accomplished. I mean, Mao said, I've changed a few counties around Peking. Don't think it's a lot else. You know what I mean? And I think there was something really important about that. And then his solution was waves of mass consciousness and revolutionary change and new things. And I think that's worth upholding and understanding it was something radically new in the world.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we kind of didn't organize this well in terms of time. By giving ourselves only an hour and a half. Huh?
Yeah,
I know, they've been calling me like...